So welcome, everyone. So it's great to have Joe Sullivan, today's speaker. So Joe is currently a PhD student with Meng Cheng at Yale University. And Joe will tell us about exotic quantum liquid and fecton in coupled wire models. Okay, Joe, go ahead.
Great. So thanks for the introduction. I suppose I should have shared my screen beforehand, so let me do that, if that's all right. Okay, great. Okay, great. So yeah, thanks for having me here. It's wonderful to be here, even though it's virtual. And so just to kind of start things off, I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators. So this talk will be based off three papers, two of them with Meng and Arpit, and one with Dominic Williamson and Tom Iadecola. So as the abstract and title suggested, I'm going to be telling you about some interesting compressible phases and also some, you know, phases that have some fracton physics. So I will start by kind of touching on that and in particular, looking at the relation between compressibility and emergent symmetries. The way that I'm going to construct these models is using this coupled wire technique. So I'll do a kind of crash course in that and then do some warm-up exercises by going through how you make like a toy model of a superfluid and of a Laplace state. Then I will move into, you know, the actual things I want to tell you about. So I'll talk about this 3D class of models. I'll do one example that corresponds to a gapped phase with planon excitations, and then I will tell you about a new compressible quantum liquid that we call the weak superfluid. And then, provided I have time, I'll advertise some other interesting wire models. Great. We all know what a compressible phase is because we all took thermodynamics or StatMech in undergrad. But just so we're on the same page, in this talk, I'll be talking about translation invariant systems. And so when I say compressible, I mean that I have some charge density and I can, when I increase the chemical potential, that the charge density is, you know, increases, strictly increases, right? So this forbids, you know, something with a gap. Like, so if I have an integer quantum Hall state, right, and I have my chemical potential right here, and I increase this, I'm obviously not going to change the density. There's going to be a plateau because there's just no states to occupy. On the other hand, you know, the kind of two quintessential examples of compressible phases that we talk about are the Fermi liquid on the fermionic side, right, and the superfluid on the bosonic side. And so, you know, what's going to be kind of key to this talk is that one way to distinguish compressible phases is to look at the IR theories of these phases and the emergent symmetry groups you get in these IR theories, and then also the associated Tuft anomalies. So just to kind of expand upon that point, you know, the basic idea is I have some, you know, filling, some, this is some, you know, microscopic quantity, and it's going to be related to some mixed Tuft anomaly between like the U1 symmetry and the translation, right? And so if I then go to, you know, and this will be present in the IR as well. And so if I go there, if I go to low energies, if I have arbitrary filling, this is going to highly constrain the types of emergent symmetry groups I can get, right? So in particular, Els Thorngren and Sentil have this work from this past year where they showed this kind of powerful result that if I have a compressible phase, the emergent symmetry group I get cannot be a compact zero-form symmetry, right? So I probably, you know, I don't want to go through the proof or, you know, get too technical. So I think the best way to like exhibit the, you know, this fact is to kind of show you how the two previous examples I touched on evade this constraint, right? So on the Fermi liquid side, you know, the main feature of a Fermi liquid is that we have this Fermi surface and you have a kind of a conserved U1 charge at each point on the Fermi surface, right? So, pardon me. So if we look at the IR theory, it turns out that the emergent symmetry group you get is something called a loop group, right? And so this just corresponds to smooth maps from the Fermi surface to the circle, right? So this is obviously a huge group, you know, has like an infinite number of conserved quantities. So it's certainly bigger than a compact Lie group. On the bosonic side, the loophole is kind of different, right? So in a superfluid, right, we have this phase and, you know, we have this like Josephson term that tends to pin this phase, right? And so if I look at, you know, loops, closed loops, where I measure the winding of the phase, this will, you know, tend to, I suppose, let me re-say this. I have these, you know, this phase degree of freedom, and then I have gapped excitations, right, which correspond to vortices, right? And so these vortices are like lines of phase slips, right? And so if I have a vortex and I measure the loop around this vortex, I'll get a jump. Right, but at low energies, these vortices are gapped, and so if I measure this winding, it will be a conserved quantity, right? And so this is an example of something that's called a higher form symmetry, right? Because basically, you know, when I measure this charge, I'm not integrating over the whole space, right? I'm integrating over these lines, right? And so the charge just, you know, the charge in two dimension is like a line-like object, right? And the charge in say three dimensions is like a planar object. So some higher dimensional object than just a point charge, right? And so, you know, some recent work has been done on this like metallic side, right? Particularly by people in the audience. And, you know, looking at quasi metals as well. But what I want to tell you about is a new example of a compressible phase on the bosonic side. So in particular, it'll be some bosonic phase where the emergent symmetry groups and the, you know, type of Tufte anomalies are distinct from these two phases. Great. So yeah, the next kind of novel feature that I advertised are fractons, right? And so this is quite a bare slide, as you can see. You know, fractons are very subject that have, you know, garnered a lot of attention and papers in the last 5 years or so. They have applications and overlap with quantum error correction, kind of weird quantum field theories, quantum glassiness, elasticity theory. But just, you know, for the sake of this talk and understanding the novel physics, I think it's sufficient to just have in your head, if you've never heard of them, that they are systems where the quasi-particles move on submanifolds. Right, so I have some emergent quasiparticle, and if it can only move in two dimensions, it's called a planon. Right, if it's, you know, restricted to move along curves, it's a linon, and if it's just totally immobile, it's a fracton. Great, so now let's kind of transition into the meat of the talk. So yeah, as I said, the method we're going to use to build up these models is this coupled wire construction, right? And so the idea here is I have these just one-dimensional quantum wires. They host these degrees of freedom phi and theta, right? And they have this kind of canonical commutation relation here. And so I interpret them in the following way. This vertex operator e to the I phi creates a boson of unit charge And then, you know, from this commutation relation, you can see that the derivative of the theta variable is going to measure the presence of these bosons. So it's kind of like the charge density, right? These are circular valued variables, right? And so my local operators turn out to correspond to vertex operators like these and, you know, integer powers of them. And then, you know, densities like this, right? And so to begin with, we just have a, you know, a free Hamiltonian. This is, you know, the effective theory of like an electron gas or something like that. And so, you know, we'll arrange some array of them like this. And initially they'll just be, you know, totally decoupled, not interacting. And then we couple them by basically introducing, you know, some, we'll take some linear combination of the bosons on different wires, right? So this, you know, denoted by this capital theta R. So these wires, you know, live on these, or these variables live on these different wires. And then we'll just introduce a Sine-Gordon term of, you know, of this object, right? And it'll have some coupling G, and we'll just crank that coupling up to kind of induce a strongly coupled phase. What we're doing here, right, is we're kind of leveraging our the power of you know, our understanding of strongly coupled physics in 1D, right? We have powerful techniques like bosonization, and we're going to use that to try and kind of build up some toy anisotropic higher dimensional strongly interacting phase. One thing I should have mentioned on the previous slide is that we can simplify our lives by, you know, when we pick these theta terms, if we pick them such that they all mutually commute, when we then crank up this coupling G, because they all mutually commute, you won't have any frustration, right? And so then we kind of get this nice semi-classical picture where this graph, you know, all of these things can be simultaneously set to zero. And so the ground state will just consist of these thetas being in some like configuration of integer multiples of 2 pi right here, right? And then above this ground state, you kind of have some very simple types of excitations. You have just oscillations about the minima, right? So you know, these two, this is theta equals zero, this is theta equals zero, and some like phonons or something like that. And then the other type of excitation you can have is some soliton, right? Where you tunnel between two allowed configurations in the ground state manifold. So these solitons will be gapped particles and they'll be localized, right? And so it's these solitons that are kind of the, you know, in my view, are the key appeal of this technique for cooking up nice toy models of like topological physics, for example. Because I, you know, I have these kinks and I have these vertex operators at my disposal, right? So something like an integral of a density will tend to move the soliton along the wire, and something like a vertex operator will, like this, will tend to move it between wires. And so then I can just play around with the, you know, operators I have at my disposal to compute topological quantities like the, you know, fusion or the braiding statistics, for example. Great. That was quite a general discussion. So now let's maybe do some examples to help, you know, let that sink in. And so the first one I want to review is just a, you know, run-of-the-mill superfluid in two spatial dimensions, right? So as I said, I have these, you know, these wires, and they host these bosonic degrees of freedom, phi and theta. And so I can add, you know, a term like this with this coupling G1 that just corresponds to a Josephson coupling, right? And so what this tends to do, just kind of pictorially here, is it'll hop a boson from, you know, one wire to the next, right? I can also introduce a coupling like this G2, right? And so this will just be a 2 pi facelift. This will hop, well, it will hop a 2 pi facelift. And so what this tends to do is, you know, I have this vortex here, and it'll hop it across a wire. we're interested in the superfluid phase, so I want to just kind of ignore this G2, right? And so in this limit, the spin waves, these oscillations about the minima, turn out to be gapless. And the solitons correspond to these vortices, right? These kind of excitations of this Josephson coupling. And these are gapped, as I said. So one kind of powerful aspect of this wire technique is it's good at explicitly realizing dualities, right? So there's these series of papers here which give some examples of this. And so I just want to advertise this for the superfluid. You know, the superfluid is kind of famously dual to compact U1 gauge theory, where, you know, the spin waves of the superfluid get mapped to the photons of the gauge theory, and then the vortices of the superfluid are just the gauge charges, right? And so we can do this in this wire model by kind of first working out what the vertex operator is that creates a vortex, right? And so if you kind of stare at this, you can see that this thing works. So you basically do e to the minus I phi to the left and e to the positive I phi to the right. This will be canonically conjugate to this Josephson term. And so then what I can do is I can just take my theory and rewrite it in these vortex variables. But you know, what I get will be non-local. And so then I do a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation, and I have to add some gauge fields. And so I indeed get this exact mapping. So clearly I haven't shown you this, right? I've just verbally told you how it goes, but I think it's, I just want to kind of let you know that this has been worked out, and we will rely on this later on, basically. So just to summarize, superfluid on this side, compact U1 gauge theory coupled to, you know, vortices on this side. Okay, so yeah, then the next example to just kind of run through is the Laughlin state. So this same type of setup where I have this 2D array of these wires, and the term I'm going to introduce looks like this. So this was worked out by Kane and others. So if you can do a computation, you can see that the spin waves for this are gapped. And you can sort of wonder where this term comes from. And so if you kind of stare at it and interpret it under the guise of this vortex basis that we just discussed on the previous slide, it turns out that what this Laughlin term does is it hops a composite of a charge and M flux, right? So you get this kind of flux attachment picture in this wire language. We can do this same, this braiding statistics calculation that I advertised when I was given the general overview. This is the operator that moves this thing along the wire. This is the operator that hops it across the wire, it being these like Laughlin anions, which are just the solitons of the model. And you get the, you know, correct braiding statistics. And then we can do this same vortex duality. And so what we get out from this calculation at the level of these wires is, you know, basically a Maxwell Trin-Simons theory, right? So you get this Trin-Simons coupling, which is precisely encoding this flux attachment that the cosine term encourages. Great. So yeah, that's kind of the end of the warm up. So now let's move into the three dimensional models that, you know, that I worked on with my collaborators. The first one I want to tell you about is this six wire model, right? So now the setup is I have this 3D array, right? And to begin with, everything is just decoupled, and the interaction term I'm going to introduce has this, you know, involves these six wires, right? So I've explicitly written it here, but it's kind of complicated looking. but we'll just pictorially represent it. You know, this picture tells you that I add all of these up. And so, you know, I'll kind of, you know, go through how to interpret this maybe phenomenologically. So again, here's the term. And so if you look at what the middle does, this is basically this Laughlin term that we just discussed, right? So this hops this composite of a charge and a flux. But then we also have these terms on the top and bottom, which hop flux as well. And so you can kind of think of this as creating a composite of charge and flux in the middle and then flux on the top and bottom. And so this, you know, composite particle is kind of encouraged and allowed to move freely by this cosine term, but, you know, isolated, you know, the original degrees of freedom are no longer, right? They're kind of gapped out. So yeah, the excitations of this model. So if you look at this, this capital theta term, all of these will mutually commute with one another, right? And so we're in this, you know, frustration-free ground state. The oscillations, you know, these spin waves are gapped when the magnitude of M is greater than the magnitude of 2N. And, you know, we also have these solitons again, and we'll, you know, we'll refer to these as the vortices of the model. So yeah, look, this is, you know, this model has these components M and N, and so, you know, we, and so these are some integers, and we can pick them, you know, depending on how we pick them, we'll get a variety of interesting physics. So let me do one of the gapped examples first. So this is this choice of M equals 3, N equals 1. And so, you know, we have this vortex that corresponds to the soliton. And so just by kind of using the vertex operators to analyze the mobility, you can conclude that it's actually immobile in Z, right? So something like this moves it along the y direction. Something, you know, this density operator allows you to move it along the wire, but there's no operator which can move this vortex in the z direction, right? So this is a planon model. But what's interesting about this is that planons in different layers have non-trivial braiding. So basically what can happen is I have some planon here in layer I, and I have some planon here in layer J, and they're spatially very separated in the Z direction, and the profile of the operator that moves it along, that moves this guy around, has some extended profile in Z, and so I get this kind of long range braiding between spatially separated planons. And yeah, so this model has you know, a number of unusual features. It's not really the thing I want to emphasize in the talk. But for example, one can compute the fusion group, and it has a very weird structure where it basically goes like Z to the, you know, Z of the nth Fibonacci number across Z of 5 times the nth Fibonacci number. For experts, this is like a example of a non-foliated fracton order. But what I really want,
can I ask a question?
Yeah, go for it.
So back to your last slide.
Yes.
So when you say there's no operator that moves the planon along Z, is there a simple way to tell that, or do you have to literally go through all the possible local operators?
I don't think it's simple. Mm-hmm. I think without, you basically have to use this. There may be a simple way, but I don't know it. The way that we computed this is to basically use this stabilizer formalism of Ha, and then just do some complicated calculation and prove to oneself that it can't be done.
Okay.
But let me have a think about it. Basically, I think we're speaking tomorrow, so I can think about it in the meantime.
Sure. All right, yeah. Thanks.
So I've just done this gapped example, but my main interest for this talk is the following. It's a gapless example, and it's compressible, but it has a number of kind of interesting properties. So it's this realization here where this M is equal to minus two N. Right. So it has this vortex excitations, this spin wave is gapless, right? If it has this like Josephson type term here, right? And then you can imagine, and then these kind of like frustrating flux hopping terms. And so when we're trying to think about what to call it, because of this Josephson term, I wanted to call it the Josephson-Sullivan model because I thought it was very funny. But my collaborators did not think it was funny. So we went with weak superfluid. Great. So the first kind of novel feature I want to discuss is the compressibility, right? And so I'll kind of show a quick and dirty way to see this. So, you know, the first is this, first thing is this observation that, this theta variable can basically be expressed as some integral of the charge density from some reference point until, the point X where you're defining it, right? So we have this kind of relation here. And so if we think about how translation will act on this theta variable, it basically will, add on, the integration of the charge density over some, one unit of between two lattice sites, right? And so what that will tend to do is increase theta by, if we interpret this as some internal symmetry, right? It will just increase theta by, units of the filling, right? So shift theta by pi times the filling, right? And so what this does is it allows us to, we can look at a particular phase and demand that it's translation invariant along the wire direction. And then this will like tend to give us constraints on the filling, right? So the first thing we can consider is just a Luttinger liquid, right? So we just have this free theory here, right? And so let's think about the symmetries of this model or this theory. We have this phi shift symmetry. And so this will just correspond to the original charge conservation. But we also get this theta shift symmetry, which will turn out to be emergent, right? But in particular, you can see that this beta is arbitrary, right? So in particular, this theta shift symmetry contains the translation. This action of translation is embedded in this theta shift symmetry, right? And so there's all sorts of interplay between there's this famous chiral anomaly going on here, but the upshot is basically that because of this emergent theta shift symmetry, this filling is unconstrained and so therefore compressible. We can look at the Laughlin state example that we kind of already talked about, right? So if we look at the symmetries, this Josephson term tells us that we have the phi shift symmetry, right? So this is the U1 charge, but this theta shift symmetry that's present at in the individual wires is now broken, right? So we no longer have this because of this theta plus theta. So if we look at how translation actually acts on this theta Laughlin term, what it does is it shifts it by 2 pi m times the filling, right? And so that gives us a constraint. If we want this cosine of this theta to be invariant, then we need the filling to be one over M or some, fraction, integer multiple of one over M, right? And that's reassuring that that's what the filling of the Laughlin state should be. And now for this weak superfluid example, right? If we look at the symmetries, we have the U1 charge conservation. But because of this N minus two N, we can see that we actually have the theta shift symmetry still. Right. And so in particular, translation just maps this term to itself. And so therefore the filling is unconstrained and we can conclude that it's compressible. The next kind of important feature that you know, one would kind of naturally want is stability, right? I've cooked up some weird model, and I'm going to claim that it has some interesting properties, but is it actually stable? And so the answer is yes. And there's kind of a quick way to see this. It's basically that, you know, I have this term and I'm in a phase where in the ground state, this term is pinned to, you know, the ground state really wants to pin this term, right? The coupling G is large, right? And so then if I look at the local vertex operators I have, right? Something like this or something like this, no local vertex operator will commute with this basically by design. And so what happens is, since they don't commute, these vertex operators create gapped excitations, right? And so if I wanted to destabilize the phase, I need to introduce some competing Sine-Gordon term, right? But all of them will immediately be irrelevant because they create gapped excitations, right? If, you know, we can kind of contrast this, or I can show you how this would work in a different scenario, which is if I set all these ends equal to zero, right? What I would have is, a bunch of layers of superfluids that are just decoupled. But I can, in that situation where n is equal to zero, I can certainly find, you know, operators which do commute with the cosine term. And so I can destabilize that. But once I introduce these, you know, finite ends, this will no longer be possible. And so because I can't condense any local process to drive a phase transition, we can conclude that the model is stable. Okay, another interesting property of this model is that there's no, there's a non-local order parameter, right? So we can kind of continue this trend of using the superfluid in 2D as a reference state, right? So what happens there? I have some Josephson term that condenses the phase difference, right? And so I can, you know, consider a two-point function of some operator like this, right? And when I compute how this scales, I can see that it goes like this, right? And so at where this is like the superfluid stiffness, and so at sufficiently large R, right, this will tend to a constant. And so what's going on here is I'm basically seeing that the charge, the background charge, sorry, one second. What I'm seeing here is that the U1 charge symmetry is spontaneously broken. So now we can look at this weak superfluid model, right? And so we might try to look for some local order parameter in the same way, right? But we run into this same problem that we just saw in the stability discussion, right? Which is that any of these local vertex operators don't commute with this term, right? And so if I wanted to then, if I compute the two-point function of any of these, it's automatically going to be zero, right? Because creates a gapped excitation. So we can conclude that there's no local.
Huge.
Sorry? Oh, okay. So as I said, there's no local order parameter. But what we can do is kind of relax our standards and instead look at non-local operators, so strings or something like that. And so if you kind of look at this term, you can see that I have this n minus 2nn. And of these theta terms, an operator that actually works is something like this, where I take a column of e to the I phi in the vertical direction, right? This commutes with the Hamiltonian, I can ask what happens if I compute the two-point function, and I can actually do the computation. And what I see is that it scales like this. So it scales basically in the same way, but now I have to modify my superfluid stiffness by, you know, a factor of one over the height in the one over the height, basically. And Z labels the system size in Z direction. And, you know, so for fixed NZ, as I go sufficiently far out, this will tend to a constant. And so what this is telling me is I have some symmetry breaking of the U1 charge symmetry, but now it's done by this non-local order parameter. So this is sometimes called weak symmetry breaking. I think, you know, by Levin and people like that. And so what's going on here kind of heuristically, how I think about it is I have some like super, this theory has some kind of super fluid sector, but it's been stretched out in the Z direction in some way. I have some rotor degree of freedom, but to actually measure it, I need this non-local order parameter.
So is there a ground state degeneracy associated with this symmetry breaking?
Yeah, so I think it's an interesting question. So what we'll see is that this theory has, yeah, this kind of rotor-like, if I imagine the configurations of the ground state, right? What I imagine is I have some rotor variable, and then I will also have like a topological sector that is like a clock variable, and they kind of decouple from one another. So yeah, there's like a Goldstone mode basically, which corresponds to, the Goldstone mode corresponds to, if you think about the Goldstone mode for a superfluid in 2D, just having like a coordinated excitation in each 2D layer. I'll kind of comment on that right now. Okay. Yeah. Let me tell you about the emergent symmetry of this model. Right. So for the 2D superfluid, as we've kind of already mentioned it a few times, right. But you get this emergent one form symmetry, right. Which just corresponds to the measuring of the winding of the phase around closed curves, right? So I can't change this at low energies because I have to add a gap quasiparticle to do that. So we can look at this weak superfluid model and you know, naively try to do the same thing, right? So we have some closed curve C and we just, you know, measure this loop and we want to know if, you know, this is an emergent, you know, conserved charge. And so just to kind of comment, this is the conserved charge in a conventional 3D superfluid, right? And so this is a two-form symmetry. But if you look at, you know, this operator QC and you look at this term here, you can see that it fails to commute, basically for the same reason that there's no local order parameter is why this QC does not commute with this term, right? And so it doesn't work. It's not an emergent symmetry of the theory. But what does work is if I take this QC, right? And I kind of measure it. I measure it here, and then I measure it in every single XY plane above and below, right? So here's the explicit form of it, right? It's just this QC summed over the Z direction. Right, I've kind of like partitioned my system into XY planes. I've measured the vorticity in each of these planes and I've added this all up. This has this kind of odd rigidity to it, right? So it has this cylindrical shape, right? And I can deform the curve here, provided I deform it in every single layer, right? So we call this a cylindrical one-form symmetry, right? And it is a one-form symmetry, right? Because just the charge objects are vortices. They're line-like.
Is this basically saying that the vortex has to be a straight line in Z direction?
Um, what, well, can you let, I'm not sure. What it's saying is basically the vortices have to occur in pairs, right? They have to be dipoles. Where my understanding of, you know, where this comes from is basically that if you look at what this term does here, right? This should actually be minus, this should be a minus 2n, right? Where this comes from is basically that this interaction term that gets condensed hops, you know, an n vortex and then minus 2n, right? And so this net, this sum of the vortices along the z direction will be conserved.
I see.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure if that is an answer or if it overlaps with what you asked, but
yeah, I think I was confused about something, but yeah, that helps. Thanks.
Okay. Cool.
You can have point like vortices. That's here. That's what you're saying. Unlike the 3D superfluid where vortices are tubes.
Exactly. Here exactly. You can
have point vortices. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Precisely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so let me kind of tell you about the gapped excitations. Right, so, you know, we have these solitons of these, you know, capital theta terms. And so, you know, these are gapped, right? And so naively, you might think, oh, I can move them about and, you know, they'll be, you know, they'll have some topological properties and I can braid them. But we have a gapless, you know, this model is gapless, right? So we need to be more careful, right? It could be the case that this gapless mode mediates some interaction between these solitons, and so they're not strictly deconfined, right? And so we can do a calculation, and that turns out to be true, right? So you can compute the interaction energy of, I just have these two solitons, these vortices, and I just like separate them out by some distance r. And so it scales like 1 over the square root of r. And so because of this, braiding is not well defined, basically, because I can, if I think about, you know, computing the braiding statistics of taking this around this, the dynamical phase will just kind of blow up. And so you can't really make sense of it. On the other hand, there is like a topological sector of this theory, and this corresponds to the situation where I have vortex dipoles, right? So these, if you think about these things, these are charged under this one-form symmetry, right? And so the kind of the Goldstone mode mediates something between them. These are not, right? Because I'm adding up all the vorticity, you know, along the z direction. And so braiding in this case is well-defined. We can analyze the, you know, the mobility of these excitations, and they turn out to correspond to some planons. And we can actually, you know, for some fixed system, you know, fixed height, basically everything here depends on the height in the z direction, right? And so if I fix that to be LZ, I can compute like the super selection sectors of these excitations. And it turns out to scale in this way, right? So this is going to be like the equivalent to the ground state degeneracy on the torus. And so, yeah, what ends up happening is you get this weird, this model has this character where it splits into this like superfluid like object that's weird and sort of stretched out. And then it also splits. And then the other part of it is this like fracton topological order, and they don't really talk to each other. Yeah, so just to
sorry, let me make sure I understand. So when you say the two sectors decouple, you mean that, so you have I presume you still have something like a 2D Goldstone mode or?
Yeah, the Goldstone mode is basically the, I think I mentioned this, you have.
It's the sum of phi, right?
It's z equals zero. Right. So the momentum in Z is equal to zero. So it's like, you know, the variation in the 2D planes, and then just coordinated in such a way that the Z component of the momentum is zero.
Yeah. So so the Goldstone mode presumably gives you something like 1 over L gap. And are you saying that for the topological sector, you still have those exponentially small gap there?
That's, yes. Okay. Yes.
All right, thanks.
Sure. Great. So, you know, I just kind of talked about the symmetry aspects of this weak superfluid. So I want to kind of compare to the previous phases we talked about, right? So just to conclude this portion. So in the ordinary 3D superfluid, right, we have this zero form symmetry we have a, you know, the charge U1, and then we have this two form emergent symmetry because the charge objects are planar, right? And you know, then there's some kind of mixed Hooft anomaly between these symmetries, right? And that's how we can understand the filling in that setting. For the 3D Fermi liquid, we have this loop group, so it's like smooth maps from the two sphere to U1, right? And there's also some Hooft anomaly structure going on there. And then for this 3D weak superfluid, as we've just seen, it's this one form symmetry, right? So indeed this, you know, this guy at the level of its emergent symmetries is distinct from these two examples. Obviously, you know, it's somewhat closer to the superfluid. I've only given you two examples. So let me kind of just advertise some of the physics of these models generically. So it turns out that, go even more in the direction of the effective theory for these systems, and you can kind of partition them into layers, right? And so what you get by basically using this wire duality mapping that I advertised earlier for the superfluid, what you end up getting is a gauge theory, right? But now it's like each of these layers hosts a compact U1 gauge field, and each layer has a Maxwell term, and then they basically couple by some Chern-Simons term, right? So this Chern-Simons term is encoded by this K matrix here and has some, you know, form here, you know, this form here, it's like nearest neighbor, right? This system was actually studied in the 90s by McDonald and others. And you know what they were thinking about is I'm in the lab and I have some Laughlin states or something like that, and I stack them on top of each other, and I sort of imagine that, you know, there's an interaction that's induced by the proximity, right? This has also been studied more recently by this group here, including Meng, my advisor, in the context of fracton physics, and so the kind of elevator pitch idea for this is that, you know, I have this local K matrix here, which encodes flux attachment, right? But just because this K is local, you know, it couples like, you know, this layer to its nearest neighbors, doesn't mean that K inverse is local, right? So in particular, I can look at K inverse and it can have entries along, you know, far along the row. Right. And so what that means is that if I add a charge in layer J, right, there'll be flux induced in layer I, right? And I can be far apart. And so I get some long, you know, I get some Aharonov-Bohm phase between some, you know, some planons in layer I and layer J, even if they're far away. Right. And so this is the same effect we saw in this gapped example, right? Where for this M equals three, N equals one, right? And so kind of not exclusively, but maybe generically, these gap models turn out to correspond to fracton planon phases with this long range braiding effect, right? For these gapless models, right? So this kind of layered picture was studied before our wire models, right? And so, the gaplessness condition basically corresponds to when does this K matrix have a zero mode, right? And so this is kind of confusing from the field theory perspective, at least to us, because just as a kind of quick advertisement, compact U1 gauge theory is very famously unstable in two dimensions, and this is, or two spatial dimensions, right? And so this is kind of like quasi 2D, right? And so just the stability and things like that were unclear. And so I think part of the merit of these wire models is that it gives you a microscopic model to kind of study these. And you can see that, okay, generically, they're actually stable because of this argument that I gave previously. You know, they'll kind of have these string-like order parameters. And so, you know, as of now, I think only two of these gapless examples have been studied, but it's something, you know, I think that our wire construction can sort of look at in the future. Right, so let me kind of quickly with the, how am I doing on time actually? Okay, with the time I have left, I wanna advertise some other wire models that are kind of beyond this layered Chern-Simons theory approach that I just mentioned. So the first one is this work I did with Dominic Williamson and Tom Iadecola. And so it's another 3D model, and so we call it the fractonal quantum Hall state, because the goal of this paper was to realize fractons in these wire, like true immobile quasi-particles in these wire models. So the setup is basically we have, you know, each of these wires hosts two Luttinger liquids. We have these vertex terms that just act on a single wire. And what they tend to do is condense this theta one with theta, or sorry, equate theta one with theta two. And then we kind of have this like complicated quadrupole of this Laughlin term. And you know, you can kind of recall that this Laughlin term looks like this. I won't go into too much detail because I'll provide some physical explanation for this in a moment. And translation acts trivially on these two terms, so they correspond to compressible phases. Our motivation, yeah, we have this wire model, but it was kind of motivated in the following sense, and that's that there's this kind of powerful technique in fracton models where you kind of start with some 2D topological order, for example, and you take like intersecting layers, and then you condense some anions basically on the lines or the points of intersection, and this kind of you know, recipe naturally leads to mobility restriction. Right, so it's in particular, there's this kind of famous paper, at least in the fracton community, by Malik, Chen, and Hermely, where they take some torque code layers, and they condense m particles, and what you get out is the X cube model. Right, and so what we were wondering is what happens when one does this with some chiral topological order, right? And so the natural thing to try is the Laughlin state, and so the setup is basically we take some you know, stacks of Laughlin states in the along the say z direction and some stacks of, so you know, xy plane sheets, and we stack them on top of each other, and then we take another set in the yz plane, and we kind of intersect them, right? And so this is say the line of intersection, and then what we do is we condense some process where a Laughlin anion from the horizontal layer hops across the line, and a Laughlin anion from the vertical layer hops across the line, right? So that's some kind of vague picture of what we want to do, but the other tool that we had is we had this explicit wire model by Kane, right? And so what we, since we have like a kind of a microscopic model for it, we can actually encode this process by this theta v term, and then this Plaquette term is basically what emerges at lowest order in perturbation theory, right? You know, in analogy to what happens in these stabilizer models. Great. So let me just kind of comment on the properties of this model. So it turns out to have a fracton, right? So the two pi, this soliton of the two pi kinks of the Paquette models are immobile along the wire directions and also in the discrete directions. The model has line-ons and planons as well. So there's a whole zoology of mobility restricted particles. It's stable for this same, by this same argument I gave for the weak superfluid that all local vertex operators create gapped excitations. And it has this emergent, cylindrical one-form symmetry as well. Right. So if I take a product of, this phi one plus phi two along this diagonal direction, this will commute with the Hamiltonian and just lead to this one form symmetry. Great. So the final one to advertise is this square Paquette model. I don't have a quippy name for this like the others, but the setup here is this 3D array, each wire hosts a Luttinger liquid. And then I create this square term where with these coefficients M1, M2, N1, N2, where they're integer valued. And so, you can study all the, integer coefficients you want and get a wide variety of phenomenology and get some gap models with some, line-on physics and, very, very rich class of models. But if you set M1, if you set the sum of the coefficients to zero, you'll automatically get a compressible phase, right? And so if we restrict to this class and then add an extra constraint that basically none of these integers are equal to one another, the emergent symmetry you get has this form here. It corresponds to like a membrane operator, right? So I have to take the like lowest dimensional object which commutes with the Hamiltonian is this product of e to the I phi along all of the sites, right? And so if you kind of look at what the emergent symmetry group of this system is, it's a zero form charge symmetry and then a zero form theta shift symmetry. So, if this weak superfluid is something like, it kind of has the symmetry of the superfluid, but stretched out in the Z direction. This is kind of like something that has the symmetry of a Luttinger liquid that's been stretched out in the Y and Z direction. So, this example and the previous example I've given, they've not been analyzed in the same amount of depth, but it's certainly something that I'm interested in looking at.
Is this similar to the what's called the sliding Luttinger liquid? I guess that one has infinitely many.
Zero. So the sliding Luttinger liquid, I thought, is basically just like you take the. My answer is kind of unsatisfactory in that I don't know, but I thought that the sliding Luttinger liquid is just, you add some like weird kinetic terms. I don't know.
It's basically a bunch of decoupled Luttinger liquids just arranged so that all the tunneling up interwire operators are irrelevant.
Yeah. Yeah. This is this is this a by Kane?
It's probably by multiple people. I think Chaitin also has it.
Okay. Chaitin
Mike also has a paper. I just want to make sure. So for this example, when you say it looks like a Luttinger liquid, does it look like just one Luttinger liquid, or does it look like infinitely many Luttinger liquids stacked together?
Well, so I mean, the setup is infinitely many Luttinger liquids coupled together, but I just mean that if I look at, I'm just saying from the perspective of the emergent symmetries, right? You have a global charge symmetry, and then you have a global symmetry that corresponds to uniformly shifting all of the theta variables in all of the wires.
I see. So that's So symmetry wise, it counts as basically just one Luttinger liquid. Okay. Yeah, so that's different.
Like,
yeah.
That's different. Yeah. It's like, I haven't thought about it in a great amount of depth, but superficially, it looks like it's like a fat, really fat wire or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Good. Thanks.
Sure. So let me just kind of summarize with some future directions. So the first one is basically what I just spoke about for the last 5 or so minutes, right? I have these other wire models. It's quite easy to generate these like weird compressible states in these wire models. And so I think it would be interesting to kind of analyze the effective theories in the same amount of depth as this weak superfluid example. The other, you know, thing to look at is kind of the opposite direction, right? So I have, there's this construction by Xie Chen and Meng and Michael Levin and others, right, that I cited previously, where they look at these layered Trans-Siemens models, and, you know, they're kind of mysterious, interesting. And so what we've shown is basically that this wire model kind of encompasses these models, right? And so anything that's kind of unclear, mysterious from the effective field theory of the layers, like the gapless models, can kind of be settled using these wire models. So we can do, you know, kind of, we can also do more general K matrices, right? If you give me some weird K matrix that's larger than nearest neighbor, I can cook up some wire model to describe it. And so we can do that. And then also the gapless models. So I should say, in addition to this weak superfluid model, I think Xie and Suchi and Hotat Lam have a paper forthcoming about another one of these gapless models. And then the other thing, which is kind of vague, but you know, I'll just say it nonetheless, is that this kind of motivates the question of whether or not something like this exists in 2D. So what I mean by that is there some kind of 2D compressible state with no local order parameter? So it has like a string-like order parameter or something like that. So yeah, very vague. I think if there is, it kind of exists outside of this wire framework, right? And my rationale for that is that, you know, these wire models can basically be mapped to Maxwell Trans-Siemens theories. And in the case that the K matrix is gapped, right? In the case that the K matrix you get in the Maxwell Trans-Siemens theory is non-degenerate, this just gives you a constraint on the filling. In the case that it's gapless, you know, you have a zero mode that corresponds to, will basically kind of tell you about the order parameter. But if we're in two dimensions, we can't use this argument that they're kind of, you know, they live in different layers. So you'll just get a local order parameter. I suppose that's probably it for my time. So let me just say thanks.
Okay, thank you for the interesting talk. Okay, it's question time. Let me start. So sure. In your weak superfluid state, is there some non-local transformation by which you can kind of disentangle the gapless sector from the topological sector? So somehow the KZ equals zero mode is the one that is gapless, right?
Yeah. So we can talk about the effective theory, right? Let me see if this answers the question satisfactorily. We can think about the effective theory, right? And so the effective theory is this like Maxwell Trans-Siemens theory, right? And so the gapless mode, right, just corresponds to the zero mode of the K matrix of this Maxwell Trans-Siemens theory, right? And so what we could kind of do is we could take the Fourier transform in the Z direction.
Mm-hmm.
So if we diagonalize this Maxwell Turn-Simons theory, the zero mode will just kind of become a Maxwell term, right? Mm-hmm. And then the eigenvalues that are not zero modes will be Maxwell Turn-Simons theories. So in that sense, you can kind of like take this gauge theory and split it into a sector with just a Maxwell term and then a sector with, you know, Turn-Simons terms. And you know, so in that sense, it kind of splits. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And then you can take this kind of heuristic further and say, well, okay, now I have this just pure Maxwell term. And so that's dual to a superfluid, mm-hmm. right? But this superfluid is now this like combination of all the gauge fields and all the layers. And so it's stretched out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I ask a good question? So for this infinite component Turn-Simons theory, how much do people know about the boundary theories? I presume the boundary will look weird, right?
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, I don't know how much they talk about it in their paper. I can't recall. I think, you know, Weaves can sort of... first of all, along which direction, I guess?
Probably the side surface is more interesting, I presume.
Yeah, I would say so. I don't know. But again, you and I will speak tomorrow, so I can read up about it. This is, you know, it's a paper that... The only paper really is this one by Xie, Suchi, mm-hmm. and co, and they do a lot. So they might have commented on it.
Okay.
We don't really talk about, you know, for our paper, we just sort of talk about the top layer, right? And so just like truncating these layers, and then what you can do is basically like think about the boundary conditions you can have and whether or not you use kind of break the symmetries explicitly or spontaneously, things like that. Like for, yeah. So I suppose if you take our wire model, let me see if, yeah. So this is like this K matrix term right here. Right. And so actually, you know what? I might have a slide on this, on like my extra slides, but I suppose basically what you can do in this wire model is just kind of modify the components, right? To sort of get rid of, to modify these components to get a matrix that's, if it's degenerate, it respects the one-form symmetry, but you can also just then pick your boundary terms so that this matrix gets some form that it no longer is degenerate and breaks the symmetry. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. Sorry, I'm using this iPad and I've not done it before, so it's...
Sorry, take your time.
Yeah, I don't know which combination of fingers to use. Okay, I think I don't have the slide, but anyway, I can read into the, I can look at the boundary stuff before we speak if you're interested.
Sure, thanks.
So as is well known that the 2+1D superfluid will become quasi long range order at finite temperature. So I'm curious that what will happen for your weak superfluid at finite temperature?
So I assume it would just have the same behavior, but just the scale, the kind of any stiffness parameter is just modified by this 1/nz.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So another question I have is, so here, if I understand correctly, your weak superfluid correspond to this layered transignment, stacked transignments in this gapless region, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible to replace this abelian K matrix theory with some non-abelian transignment theory? Particularly in your couple wire construction, can you construct some such phase?
That's a very interesting question. What I would say is, it's certainly possible to get non-abelian. Like I can make a, there are papers that do more read state in the wires, right? Here's what I would say. I know how to do non-abelian in the wire models. And this is, I've thought about this before, like how would the mapping work? But I don't know about, I'm not sure about like say stacked layers. One thing that I would say you could do is maybe this approach with the intersecting layers, right? So, where is this slide? So this one, right? You can imagine sort of taking the wire models for the for say like a Moore read state or something like that, which has been worked out, and then condensing some process and seeing what you get out to get some sort of non-abelian stuff. I just don't know how. So for like non-abelian transignments, you need like trace of gauge fields. So I don't know how I'm having a hard time picturing the mapping, I guess. But I would be interested in thinking about something like that.
Yeah, I guess for non-abelian gauge field, you don't get this mutual transignment term, right? So probably that give you some trouble of stacking them together.
What was the I didn't hear the last thing you said.
I mean, for non-abelian gauge field, you don't have this mutual transignment, right? You don't have mutual transignment term, so probably that gives you some trouble of stacking them together.
Yeah. Okay.
Or you can probably still think about various anion condensates.
Yeah. Well, what I would say is that on the side of the wire, like, I advertise that this duality, you know, people know how to do like kind of explicit duality mappings using this technique. But I don't know if I've seen any kind of like non-abelian stuff. I think it's maybe confusing and hard to work out. This is, people like Jason Alicia and others.
Yeah, but you can certainly do non-abelian quantum hole using copper wire, right?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, you can. I think I have a slide on this too. You can do more read by basically, where is it? You can do more read by adding, you need like two Luttinger liquids per wire. And then you kind of like, what you do is you, I must not actually have this slide, but what you do is you kind of like fine tune it so that you can you add some interactions. And then if you fine tune the kinetic term, you can re-fermionize so that you're kind of left over with a Majorana moda on the boundary.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, sure. Actually, I have a really dumb question. I probably missed something very basic and you probably explained it already. So if I look at the K matrix for the compressible case, the N equal to 2M case, So I understand if when you have periodic boundary condition that has a zero eigenvalue. What happens if you have just open boundary conditions, so you don't have the one between one and L, let's say.
Sure.
Do you have to worry about that zero mode getting a tiny gap or something?
So yeah, I think you can, it depends on, so this will then correspond to something in the wire model, right? Some choice of boundary conditions. Mm-hmm. And so you have, if you just like naively truncate, you have some leftover degrees of freedom, right? And so you can try and, you can kind of pick your edge theory how you want, right? And so, I suppose if you pick it so that the one form, this like zero mode is no longer a zero mode. I suppose it would have some gap kind of proportional to the, that's just set by these like point excitations at the edges or something like that, right?
Okay, so your so the 2D ghost zone mode will now be a quasi ghost zone mode only, or?
Yeah, I guess so.
Mm-hmm, I see.
It's broken at the surface, right? Yeah.
I see. Okay. Okay, I guess it makes sense. The order parameter is non-local, so it's probably more sensitive to boundary condition.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Sure.
I thought maybe you have this U1 one form symmetry and zero form symmetry, and they are anomalous. So maybe that protects the gaplessness or not.
I guess that the anomaly is more like, if it's anomalous, shouldn't it say that when you have a boundary, the symmetry more or less has to be not there?
It depends what you mean by anomaly. It's like a 2D symmetry, right? So if you have a boundary that's in 2D, it's not like really giving you a boundary, right? If you choose the horizontal boundary, it's like, as a 2D system, it's not a boundary.
Oh yeah, you're right. Yeah, in 2D it's fine.
I thought the one form symmetry is broken at the boundary, isn't it?
Depending on how you pick your boundary condition.
If you just have open boundary.
If it's just an open boundary, it will be unbroken, I think. Because it's basically, this one form symmetry commutes with all the Plaquette terms. So if you just kind of throw one of them away, it would still be there.
But is there a reason why, like microscopically, like this one form symmetry is an emergent symmetry, right? So do we know for a given microscopic theory of a boundary, whether the one form symmetry would be present or not?
So can you clarify, what we're kind of doing here is we're building up, we're doing like gradations of effective field theory, right? Where we take these like wires that are already kind of pre-coarse grained. So what do you mean by microscopically at the boundary? Do you mean at the level of, I have some wires that I'm coupling together?
Well, maybe I'm thinking really of a lattice model at the end of the day, but maybe the other way to say it is just whether the in the bulk, in the field theory, the terms that would break for one form symmetry are, irrelevant perturbations. But is that also the case at the boundary?
Um, No, I don't think so. I think that you can find, you can kind of willingly, there are different choices of boundary conditions you can pick, which commute with the bulk, which either explicitly or you know, which break the one-form symmetry or don't.
Yeah, in that case, you might think that if there's a lattice model, that it will always break the one-form symmetry because you would have to fine-tune to get the one-form symmetry. Is that right? Like in the field theory, does it look like the one-form symmetric boundaries are fine-tuned or not? Forgetting about the lattice model, just in the field theory.
Just in the field theory, just, yeah, I suppose, I mean, one doesn't seem more fine-tuned than the other, I suppose, because it's just a choice of, I mean, yeah, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but it's just a choice of the entry in the K matrix.
Right. There's not a continuous parameter that you, it's like no. Just some discrete choice.
It's discrete, right? Because these, yeah, I mean, it just, you know, this is stemming from the, you know, basically the vertex operators are kind of discrete, right? And so it leads to this, yeah, discrete choice of the K matrix. I don't know, maybe we can discuss this in more depth tomorrow.
Yeah.
I'd be interested. I honestly like haven't thought about it.
Cool.
And if you have, say, periodic boundary condition along the g-direction,
mm-hmm.
and you have open boundary in the other direction, so you have this gapless surface mode coupled with the Borg Goldstone mode, I guess, right? So there's a 2D gapless state coupled with 3D gapless mode.
Hold on, you should be able to, I mean, so the presence of the 3D, let me look at the term actually. So you need something, right, that commutes with, need something that commutes with, oh, my Apple Pencil has died. Sorry, Sunset, can you say that again? So you're basically just wondering, like, what is the interplay between the kind of bulk Goldstone mode and like maybe some like chiral edge?
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, I don't know. This is maybe not something that we addressed.
So there's no quantized response, say thermal hole from the chiral mode due to the bulk gapless mode. Is that right? Or
I don't think so.
Okay. Any more question from the audience? Okay. If not, let's thank Joe for a very interesting talk. And we'll talk more tomorrow.
Great. Yeah. Thanks. Looking forward to speaking with you all.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.